Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. A U.S. Senate committee Tuesday examined the workings of the Transportation Security Administration after a recent audit showed the agency had failed to identify 73 workers with links to terrorism. The report comes days after news broke that an internal report found that airport checkpoint screeners failed to detect fake explosives and weapons in most of the tests carried out by undercover federal agents. Speaking before the Senate Homeland Security Committee, the Department of Homeland Security's Inspector General John Roth told the panel,
"Since 2004, we have published more than 115 audit and inspection reports about TSA's programs and operations. We have issued hundreds of recommendations to attempt to improve TSA's efficiency and effectiveness. We have conducted a series of covert penetration tests, essentially testing TSA's ability to stop us from bringing in simulated explosives and weapons through checkpoints, as well as testing whether we could enter secure areas through other means. We identified vulnerabilities caused by human and technology-based failures."
Roth also said that better training of safety officers to eliminate human error and better maintaining of screening equipment would go a long way to improving safety and efficiency of the agency. Two escaped murderers facing life in prison remain on the loose after a daring prison break in New York. Authorities are offering a $100,000 reward for information that leads to the capture of David Sweat, 34, and Richard Matt, 48. Guards discovered the convicted killers were missing early Saturday from a cell in the maximum security Clinton Correctional Facility, which is located close to the U.S.-Canada border. You are listening to The Voice of America, coming to you from Washington, D.C. U.S. President Barack Obama stressed the need to more quickly train Iraqi troops in order to succeed in fighting against Islamic State fighters, saying Monday that Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi agrees on the desire for more security forces who are trained, fresh, well-equipped, and focused. The two leaders met Monday in Germany in the latest high-level effort to strategize against the militant group that swept through large areas of Iraq a year ago and has persisted in some of the biggest cities despite a U.S.-led campaign of airstrikes backing Iraqi ground forces. Mr. Obama said recruiting, particularly from Sunni tribes, needs to be a priority.
"One of the things that we're still seeing is in Iraq, places where we've got more training capacity than we have recruits."
He also reiterated the need to stop the flow of foreign fighters, saying thousands of militants are still going into Syria and on to Iraq. An Egyptian court sentenced 11 people to death Tuesday in connection with a 2012 riot at a soccer stadium in the northern city of Port Said that left 74 people dead and injured hundreds more. Families and friends of those who died in the violence waited outside court, some of them angry that the police at the scene of the football clashes were not held more accountable. The court on Tuesday also sentenced 40 defendants to terms of up to 15 years while acquitting 20 people. The sentences can be appealed. Debt-ridden Greece offered a new economic reform plan, that is, to its international creditors Tuesday, searching for a way to avoid a default at the end of June. Details of the new ideas Athens sent to its leaders were not disclosed, but some officials said they focused on revised fiscal targets for Greece's beleaguered government and new ways to generate revenue. Greece's new radical leftist government is engaged in a standoff with its creditors, the International Monetary Fund, the European Central Bank, and Greece's European neighbors over implementing ongoing austerity reforms. The South Korean Health Ministry has announced the death of a seventh person from Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS. The ministry said Tuesday the victim is a 68-year-old woman who had been in the emergency room of a Seoul hospital where previous infections have taken place. It also said there are eight new cases of the outbreak, bringing the total number now of infections to 95. China on Tuesday slammed the Group of Seven Nations for making irresponsible remarks about Beijing's disputed territorial claims in the East and South China Seas. In a statement at the end of a summit in Germany on Monday, G7 leaders expressed concern about Asian maritime tensions and called on all sides to respect international law. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehia Yiswu-Hib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
At the moment, there are some 600 refugees arriving on average every day in the Greek islands. They are coming from countries such as Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, and other countries experiencing conflict.
That's William Spindler of the UN Refugee Agency describing the worsening refugee crisis in the Greek islands. Details coming up. Also in the news, Burundi's Electoral Commission has proposed new dates for the presidential and parliamentary elections. And South Sudan's negotiators are once again gathering in Ethiopia to try to end the 18-month-old conflict dividing the world's youngest country. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Benin, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the refugee crisis in the Greek islands is steadily growing worse. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, says record numbers of people are arriving in rubber dinghies and wooden boats. About 16 islands are seeing refugee arrivals, but most are landing on the shores of Lesvos. William Spindler is a spokesman for UNHCR. From Lesvos, he spoke to VOA's Jody Kapua.
At the moment, there are some 600 refugees arriving on average every day in the Greek islands. They are coming from countries such as Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, and other countries experiencing conflict. And about half of those, about 300 a day, are arriving here in Lesbos, which is a small island very close to the Turkish coastline. And the local people and the local authorities are doing a very good job trying to cope with this large number of refugee arrivals. But the local services and facilities are overstretched, and people are finding difficulty finding somewhere to stay. There is a reception center, but it's full. It has an official capacity of 400 people, and at the moment, over 1,000 people are staying there under very difficult conditions. The police giving them food on a regular basis, but the quantities of the food are not sufficient. Greece is undergoing a very important economic crisis, and the local authorities, the police, the mayor, the Coast Guard, are struggling to cope with very little resources. So we are appealing for help for Greece at this moment when they have been receiving large numbers of refugees from the Middle East and Africa.
Now, once UNHCR identifies, screens, and registers the arrivals on Lesbos, what happens to the refugees?
Once they are registered, they are given a document that allows them to leave the island. Before that, they are technically under arrest and they can't leave. So once they have that document, they can buy a ticket on the ferry and they leave for the mainland. They don't stay here. So every day there's people also leaving Lesbos, but there's always a population of between 2,000 and 2,500 refugees, but they are not the same ones. People come and go. They leave for the mainland of Greece, and some of them ask for asylum there, and some of them continue their journeys to other countries in Europe. In fact, most of them continue to countries such as Sweden and Germany, where some of them have relatives.
Now, I know Germany is one of the countries taking many of these refugees. Have you heard of any problems in Germany or Sweden about the influx of the refugees?
Well, those countries have been very generous in receiving large numbers of refugees, but we understand that there also are concerns about the capacity of receiving them. But on the whole, those countries have been very welcoming, and we are very grateful for that. The problem is that to get there, refugees often need to take long, dangerous journeys overland after having risked their lives once coming to Greece. They need to go again in an irregular way, and sometimes through the mountains, for instance, between Greece and Serbia or Macedonia or Bulgaria, the Balkans route. And this is often very, very dangerous as well.
Now, as you know, we've been following the situation from Libya, where thousands of refugees and migrants are crossing the Mediterranean this year. Many have died trying to reach Europe. How has the situation on the Greek islands complicated this migrant refugee crisis?
The situation in Greece is in many ways comparable to that of Italy in the sense of the numbers of people arriving. But while the numbers have been steady in Italy compared to last year, in Greece the numbers have gone up considerably. So numbers of arrivals in both Greece and Italy are consistent to those that we saw last year on the whole. But in the case of Greece, the numbers are much higher than they were last year. That's one way in which the situation has changed. The other complication is that people who are arriving in small islands in Greece are finding conditions there very difficult because these are very small communities that are living mainly from tourism. They don't have the facilities to receive large numbers of refugees who need shelter, food, medical attention. Yesterday at the reception center here in Lesbos, I was talking to some doctors who treat the refugees, and they told me that they have encountered refugees who have war wounds, who have been shot or who have been victims of bombings or explosions in Syria and in other places.
William Spindler is a spokesman for UNHCR from the Greek islands of Lesbos. He spoke to VOA's Jody Capua. In the meantime, the Associated Press reports that hundreds of rescued migrants from sub-Saharan Africa are in Sicily today. This after being rescued by the Italian Coast Guard off the coast of Libya yesterday. Some of the migrants were taken from three rubber dinghies, others from a Thai merchant ship that had also participated in the rescue. Officials say the 447 migrants are now at the Sicilian port of Pazzallo. The UN says nearly 50,000 have crossed the Mediterranean Sea to Italy so far this year. Yesterday, Burundi's Electoral Commission proposed new dates for elections, July 15th for the presidential poll and June 26th for parliament. Both polls had been delayed since violent protests erupted nearly 2 months ago over President Pierre Nkurunziza's decision to run for a third term. But wire services report today that Burundi's opposition has rejected the new poll dates. The opposition did not attend yesterday's meeting of the commission and have called on the president to step down. They also say the Electoral Commission lacks the legal authority to make any pronouncements because two of its five commissioners are believed to have fled the country. Meanwhile, civil society groups in Burundi have written a letter to the Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon. They say they oppose Said Djinnit, the UN facilitator of talks between the opposition and the government. The opposition says they believe he supports President Nkurunziza. A Burundi government spokesman said the opposition's criticism of Djinnit shows they lack maturity. South Sudan's negotiators are once again gathering in Ethiopia to try to solve the 18-month-old conflict dividing the world's youngest country. As Martha van der Wolf reports from Addis Ababa, the warring factions only have 1 month left to form an international mandated power-sharing government.
Once again, delegations from South Sudan's government, the rebel opposition, and the former detainees are meeting to find a solution to the crisis sparked a year and a half ago when President Salva Kiir had a political fallout with his former deputy, Riek Machar. South Sudan is expected to form a transitional government of unity by July 9, the country's fourth anniversary of independence. But with just 1 month to go, it is not clear this deadline will be met. The last round of talks ended in early March without any kind of agreement, and the current agenda has to be finalized. Monday's talks amounted to consultations on ways forward and a new negotiating mechanism, also known as IGAD+. IGAD is the East African bloc that has been mediating talks throughout the conflict. IGAD Plus would now include the African Union, European Union, Britain, the United States, Norway, and China as new members. Lead mediator Siyu Mesfin of IGAD underscored at the last round of talks that the fighting parties must not fail to find a lasting peaceful solution.
The whole world is watching the conflict in South Sudan, and we call on IGAD, the AU, the United Nations, and all international partners to join us in calling for an end to this conflict now.
Several ceasefire agreements have been signed and broken since January 2014. UN Security Council approving sanctions also failed to stop the hostilities. Fighting has flared ahead of these talks, especially in the major oil-rich Unity state. Thousands have died, more than 2 million displaced. 300,000 people alone have taken refuge in Ethiopia. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
You were listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Sixteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. The refugee crisis in the Greek islands is steadily growing worse. Burundi's Electoral Commission has proposed new dates for the presidential and parliamentary elections. And South Sudan's negotiators gather in Ethiopia to try to end the 18-month-old conflict dividing the country. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. An Egyptian court sentenced 11 people to death today in connection with a 2012 riot at a soccer stadium in the northern city of Port Said that left 74 people dead and injured hundreds more. Egypt's worst case of soccer violence began at the end of a match between Cairo's Al Ahly and the home Al Masri team when local fans stormed the field and clashed with visiting fans. The court today also sentenced 40 defendants to terms up to 15 years while acquitting 20 people. The sentences can be appealed. The Bonn Climate Change Conference continues in its second week. The meeting sets the stage for negotiations at the COP21, the main climate conference that will be held in Paris in December. While the Bonn Conference continues, G7 leaders yesterday concluded their summit elsewhere in Germany. They pledged to phase out greenhouse gas emissions over the course of the century. Jennifer Morgan is the global director of the climate program at the World Resources Institute. She's attending the Bonn conference and spoke to VOA's Jody Kapowa about whether any progress is being made.
Well, I think it's pretty clear that they need to accelerate the pace of the negotiations. They've been working hard to try and make this 90-page negotiating text more understandable, show the choices more clearly and the options, but it's still stuck in a number of different places. And so I think by the time they leave, it needs to be a much clearer text that ministers then can engage with over the summer.
Now, why is this document so important?
So this document that they're negotiating now will be the basis for the Paris Agreement. They need to take those 90 pages and get them down to, say, maybe 15. It includes all the main ideas that countries have of what should be in the agreement. So this is the basis that they're working on.
What are the main issues that you see so far?
So there's a number of key issues. One is whether or not there's a long-term goal that would send signals into investors and the public to phase out greenhouse gases or decarbonize the economy included in the agreement. Another is whether countries would strengthen their commitments to reduce emissions and scale up renewables every 5 years, or whether that would be longer. A key issue is adaptation. Many developing countries, Africa, small island nations, want to make sure that there's enough support for countries to adapt to the impacts because they are already happening and having great influence on people's lives. And then the big question is the finance piece. How both do you support developing countries in implementing this agreement, but also shift investment around the world into the solutions we need?
Now, being that this is held in Bonn, Germany, is the German government taking the lead on this?
The German government in these negotiations is just like any other country. It's the Secretariat is here in Bonn. But I think it is a bit symbolic. Germany has a very ambitious 80% target for renewable energy by 2050. They've got 30% already in their country. They're really at the forefront of figuring out how to do this.
What about the issues that are most important for the World Resources Institute? Have you seen any progress on those?
One of the key issues we see a need for is this kind of a long-term signal that the path is going in only one direction, and we were very encouraged by what the G7 said about this decarbonization of the world's economy over the course of this century. We're seeing some movement on things like increasing ambition every 5 years, but that, I think, is not yet there. There's some countries that are looking for 10 years to wait 10 years till they improve their commitments. And, you know, on adaptation, which is a big priority for us as well, I think there's a great interest to figure out how to build something that is really supportive for vulnerable countries. It's still in formulation, though, I would say, at this point in time in the negotiations.
The leaders of the world's major industrial democracies have resolved to wean their energy-hungry economies off carbon fuels. But when you see such an increase in the practice of fracking to release so many more carbon fuels for availability, isn't that going in the opposite direction?
Well, I think the G7 decision to decarbonize the world's economy and shift out of fossil fuels over the course of this century, I think, is an incredibly important signal. It doesn't yet mean that even those G7 countries, unfortunately, are in the midst of doing all that they can do. So whether it be fracking, whether it be plans to build new coal-fired power plants like Japan is considering, whether it be the tar sands of Canada, all of those are inconsistent with that signal. So there's work to be done to align those and accelerate the short-term pace of what's happening right now to achieve that long-term goal.
Jennifer Morgan is the Global Director of the Climate Program at the World Resources Institute from Bonn, Germany. She spoke to VOA's Jody Kapua. Last week, a summit of justice ministers from Western North Africa announced the creation of a regional law center. The Dakar-based center would train police and judicial officials, and it would work to improve national policies related to fraud, tax evasion, and other types of corruption that impede development. The program would be implemented by the UN Development Program. Alejandro Alvarez is a spokesman for the Rule of Law, Justice and Security team in the UNDP's Bureau for Policy and Program Support. Reporter William Eagle asked him how corruption affects development.
It is calculated that, you know, several billion dollars, you know, are being lost because of corruption. Corruption that you can find in customs systems, in the, you know, official procurement systems, you know, in the, you know, justice system, in political systems. And so we calculate, you know, several other institutions calculate that, you know, what the continent is losing is several billions of dollars because of that, that therefore cannot be invested into, more productive initiatives, education, supporting private sector, and so on and so forth. And then, you know, it's been, you know, proven, you know, several times that when corruption is the rule, it's going to be very difficult for the private sector to develop, because you need, you know, clear rules, you know, to compete, you know, in the market, you know, to know exactly to produce, you know, jobs, and, you know, to know exactly, you know, what kind of investment you can do, you know, over time. So, you know, corruption has, you know, a devastating effect in development. So the center will be very much concentrated into making justice system more performant to prosecute and to convict corruption acts.
The UNDP is also working with West African nations to establish better tax collection and encourage more transparent budgets. These seem like economic issues. To what extent are they legal issues that could be resolved by better legal training from the Senegal Center?
Let's take the tax collection issue, right? certainly what you need there is, on one side, you have all, you know, work related to, you know, building the budget, you know, agreeing on the budget. So the parliament, the Minister of Finance, and everybody, you know, it's, there is a process, you know, to build the budget. You know, UNDP helps countries, you know, to do this budgeting process, you know, effective and according to the needs. But on the other side, you also have, you know, the tax collection process, where, you know, in many places, corruption is certainly an important issue to tackle. And actually, you know, this rule of law center, what it's going to do is to make sure that where there are corruption issues, where there are criminal acts related to tax collection, you know, prosecution and the justice system will be able to crack on those behaviors. So the link between the center and this kind of work is that the center will mainly focus on justice actors to be able to prosecute eventually, you know, crimes related to, you know, tax collection or, you know, any other fiscal criminal behavior.
And I understand that also UNDP will be working, and I suppose the center will be working to improve the implementation and some of the problems with implementation facing these countries in terms of having signed international and regional conventions on the rule of law. There are problems and significant challenges in terms of implementation. What are a couple of those challenges that you hope to resolve?
Let me take a couple of examples. Like, for example, the United Nations Convention Against Corruption. UNCAC. You know, there is one part of the UNCAC that relates to prosecution of corruption acts. And, you know, for African countries at this very moment, prosecuting and convicting, those acts is a tremendous challenge. Let's say that, you know, you want to prosecute, you know, a fraud, you know, with in procurement systems, you know, in public procurement. Well, you need accountants, you need, good forensics that are related to, financial, there had to be financial knowledge. I mean, all these elements are not, you know, still there in the prosecution services in these countries. So prosecuting these acts is a very complicated task. So what we are willing to, or what we are interested to, is to make sure that through the center we train, we develop capacities of these countries, you know, to make sure that, you know, criminal prosecution for corruption can be done.
That was Alejandro Alvarez of the UN Development Program. He was speaking with reporter William Eagle. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suohib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Happening Africa. This is Jackson Bungani in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
And AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this, whatever?
Employment rates are climbing. So definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The refugee crisis in the Greek islands is steadily growing worse. Burundi's Electoral Commission has proposed new dates for the presidential and parliamentary elections. And South Sudan's negotiators gather in Ethiopia to try to end the 18-month-old conflict dividing the country. Coming up, music from Benin, and in our feature segment, the wife of Nigeria's new president, Muhammadu Buhari, publicly opposes the practice of child marriage. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday, Yehiz.
I understand Women's World Cup football tops your sports report of this evening.
Yehiz, it's the fourth day of competition at the Women's World Cup football tournament in Canada. And let's give a sunny side of sports shout out for Gael and Ganamuit and the indomitable Lionesses of Cameroon. Gael, who is celebrating her 23rd birthday today, got an early birthday present on Monday when she scored a hat trick as Cameroon routed Ecuador 6-0 in Vancouver in the tournament debuts for both teams. Gael was named the player of the match, and speaking after the game, she said the honor was a fantastic souvenir of her first World Cup match, as well as a lovely birthday present. The Cameroonian ladies now top the Group C table in Canada, and next up will be a formidable opponent. They'll play reigning world champion Japan on Friday in Vancouver. The Japanese women edged Switzerland 1-0 on Monday. Aya Miyama scored on a penalty kick in the 29th minute. In other results Monday, Nigeria and Sweden battled to a 3-3 draw in a very entertaining match played in Winnipeg, Canada. The big heroine for the Super Falcons of Nigeria was striker Francisca Ordega, who scored the equalizer in the 87th minute. While Ordega celebrated with her teammates, Nigeria's head coach Edwin Okon dropped to his knees and kissed the artificial turf on the sideline. Nilla Fischer had put Sweden up 2-0 in the first half with a goal in the 31st minute after Nigeria conceded an own goal. But the Super Falcons of Nigeria, the most successful African women's team over the years, showed their fighting spirit. And Ngozi Okobi and Asisat Oshola scored in a three-minute span in the second half to even the match at 2-2. Linda Sembrant came off the bench to put Sweden up 3-2 with a goal before Ordega's big goal for the Super Falcons. Final score from Winnipeg, Nigeria 3 and Sweden 3. And this quick club note about 21-year-old Francisca Ordega: when she's not playing for the Super Falcons, she's based right here in Washington, where she plays for the Washington Spirit Club in the National Women's Soccer League. In another Women's World Cup match played in Winnipeg Monday, the United States defeated Australia 3-1. Megan Rapinoe was the player of the match for the USA. She scored two goals and helped set up the third by Kristen Press. Megan was asked how she felt after she scored her first goal in the 12th minute.
A little relieved, I think, more than anything. I think obviously we were a bit nervous. Couldn't have played much worse at times, but got three goals, and Hope Solo was freaking huge today. And everybody stepped up, so it's big. I mean, obviously, first tournament for a lot of people. It's only my second first game, so to get out of here with the win, 3 points, is huge. On to the next.
On to the next, Megan. The next match for Megan Rapinoe and the two-time world champion U.S. women's team will be Friday when they play Sweden in Winnipeg, Canada. And that same day, the Super Falcons of Nigeria are matched against the Matildas of Australia in Winnipeg. This seventh edition of the Women's World Cup is the first to be played on artificial turf, a controversial issue since the players say the surface makes them more susceptible to injuries. One of the most outspoken critics is veteran American star Abby Wambach.
Playing on turf affects everything, you know, it affects the way the ball rolls, it affects the way the ball bounces, it affects the way you think about whether or not going into a slide, slide tackle. Should I slide and toe poke this ball into the goal and deal with bloody knees, bloody hip bones? It's kind of a nightmare, but at the end of the day, it is what it is. You gotta deal with it.
That's American soccer star Abby Wambach talking about the artificial turf being used at the Women's World Cup in Canada. The 35-year-old Wambach is one of the most decorated players in history. Abby holds the world record for international goals for both male and female players with 182. A two-time Olympic champion, Abby Wambach was named the 2012 FIFA Women's World Player of the Year.
Friends, we can all listen to the sunny side of sports.
Yes, my friend.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of life.
Voice of America, VOA, Washington.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the sunny side of sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America, VOA.
I encourage our VOA listeners with internet access to check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. The address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. Once again, that address, facebook.com/VOA Sunny. You'll see photos and videos, and you can post your comments. So check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page.
Voice of America.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
They're playing basketball. We love that basketball.
The National Basketball Association finals resume later Tuesday night in Cleveland, Ohio. That's where the Cleveland Cavaliers will host the Golden State Warriors in Game 3 of the Best of 7 Championship Series, which is tied at 1-1. The first two games both needed an overtime period before they were decided. The Warriors won the first game 108-100, but the Cavaliers bounced back by taking the second game 95-93. Cleveland's head coach, David Blatt, comments on the competitive nature of the series.
You know, we are playing a pretty good team. It's not going to be easy. I don't know that we'll see any easy games in this series, and I suppose it could happen, but the two teams are really battling and playing the game hard. I think playing it right.
In Game 2 of the NBA Finals, Cavaliers star LeBron James turned in another outstanding all-around performance, tallying 39 points, 16 rebounds, and 11 assists. The Cavs will again be leaning on LeBron in Game 3 to lead the way. And LeBron wants the Cleveland fans to make some noise.
I'm looking forward to seeing our fans, and I can't wait to see our fans. And I've heard our fans pretty loud before. A couple instances, my first postseason appearance was really loud, and me coming home against the Knicks at the start of the season was pretty good, but I know we can be much, much louder than any fan base, you know, in this league. And I know they're getting ready, and I can't wait to see them.
Meanwhile, we'll see if Golden State star Stephen Curry has his sharp-shooting eye back in Game 3 after an uncharacteristic poor shooting night in Game 2. Curry, the league's reigning most valuable player, took 23 shots from the field and made only 5, and he set a NBA Finals record by missing 13 three-point shots. In Curry's words, "I doubt that this will happen again. Shots I normally make, I knew as soon as they left my hand that they were off. That doesn't usually happen." Our Daybreak Africa sportsman Mark Ouma joins us now with a package of African athletic news.
South Africa's Hendrico Branches and Antonio Alcana, along with Morocco's Hicham Singweni, triumphed in lifetime bests at the José Odlozil Memorial Meet in Prague in the Czech Republic on Monday night. Branches clocked 10.06 seconds in 100 meters. Alcana won the 110-meter hurdles in 13.42 seconds, while Singweni prevailed in 3,000-meter steeplechase in 8 minutes and 21.10 seconds. All three qualify for the World Athletics Championships due in Beijing, China, in August. South African Wenda Nell and Ethiopian Buse Deriba won women's 400-meter hurdles and 3,000 meters, respectively. Kenyan Julius Yego won the javelin with a throw of 91.39 meters, the furthest throw in over 9 years at the IAAF Diamond League in Birmingham, Britain on Sunday. It's an African and Diamond League meet record. South African Wade Van Niekerk won the 300 meters in 31.63 meters, another African record. Kenya's James Magut and Thomas Longosiwa won the 1500 meters and 5000 meters respectively. Botswana's Nigel Amos and Kenyan Eunice Sum triumphed in men's and women's 800 meters as Virginia Nyambura won women's 3,000-meter steeplechase. In France, Morocco's Abdelati Igida won men's 1,500 meters in 3 minutes and 32.88 seconds, the world's quickest time in the event this year at the Tour of Marseille meet on Saturday. Morocco's Rababi Arafi and Ivory Coast's Marie-José Lou Goneri won women's 1,500 meters and 100 meters respectively, as Zambian Kabanga Mupopo was second in women's 400 meters.
Thanks, Mark. That's Mark Ouma of our Daybreak Africa radio show, reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa. Finally, in tennis, 9-time French Open champion Rafael Nadal's loss in the quarterfinals dropped him 3 places to number 10 in the latest ATP rankings. That's his lowest spot since April of 2005. Meanwhile, the French Open champion Stan Wawrinka rose from number 9 to number 4 in the rankings. Novak Djokovic maintained a healthy lead at number 1, despite losing to Wawrinka on Sunday in the final in Paris. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yeheyes Wuhee.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, the second part of a series on old-fashioned Johannesburg. And next, the wife of Nigeria's new president, Muhammadu Buhari, publicly opposing the practice of child marriage. But first, some music. Here is Angelica Kidjo of Benin with Agolo. Angelica Kijo of Benin with Agolo. South Africa's biggest city, Johannesburg, is a place of poverty but also immense wealth. People clutching smartphones and tablet computers fill the streets. New highways twist around skyscrapers. Technology abounds. But while the city is modernizing rapidly, some residents choose to hold on to reminders of its past. Darren Taylor reports in the second part of a series on old-fashioned Johannesburg. Today, he looks at a store that specializes in old-fashioned entertainment, comic books.
A cargo plane flies over a dank warehouse while a worker unpacks boxes at O.R. Tambo Airport near Johannesburg. The freight belongs to a bespectacled man in his late 20s, dressed all in black, Scott Brimson.
We get our comics every single week from America, all sorts of stuff. That's the wonderful thing about comics. No matter who you are, there's something for you.
Brimson's store is in a nondescript side street near one of Johannesburg's busiest routes. Cosmic Comics is sandwiched between a bakery and a tire fitment center. Outside the shop, the real world rages. Inside, a fantastical universe of color and escapism blooms. A customer flips through comics.
It's too numerous to really go through. I mean, there's just tons and tons and tons. I mean, comics have been going since the 30s and no sign of slowing down. And new characters and new writers, new artists are always coming in. So
the shop's shelves hold thousands of titles protected by thick plastic covers.
Everything from Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Green Lantern, Flash, Iron Man, Captain America, Doctor Strange.
Brimson sells a lot of Hellboy comics, advertised in this DVD.
In 1944, a demon was summoned to Earth to wage war. But the child of hell was rescued by good men who taught him honor, kindness, and a sense of right.
Brimson emphasizes that comics are no longer the sole preserve of children. He says most of his clients are adults. They can afford to pay the 200 to 300 rand, or $20 to $30. That's the average price of an imported comic book. Brimson adds that many readers aren't into predictable happy endings. They prefer darker comics, like the new Batman series, Court of Owls.
Absolutely fantastic. Batman doesn't win. There are people who are smarter and better than Batman. In Court of Owls, it's a group who go to Batman and go, "We know who you are. We know what you're doing. You're stepping on our toes now. Stop it, or we will stop you." Batman does stop them, but he doesn't win by any stretch of the imagination.
Another of his popular titles is Saga. On the cover of one issue, giant green vines capture a man in a forest.
It's a melting pot of ideas. You've got these two characters who are from opposite sides of an intergalactic war. Her faction is more like the sort of fairy types, but they're more technologically advanced. His race use actual magic. So it's the science fiction, magic, romance, horror amalgamation. It's a really, really good series.
Brimson pages through a Hellblazer comic. It's for adults only, featuring lots of graphic violence. Its main character is a hard-drinking, chain-smoking, womanizing, rough and rude detective in a dirty brown overcoat.
John Constantine, anti-hero, not Keanu Reeves. Blonde British bastard. He basically is out for nothing but himself. He will help you if it's going to help him. And
Brimson says paper comics are increasingly popular in South Africa, even in an age when most titles are a click away online. He maintains that old-fashioned comics have much more aesthetic merit and also actual monetary value than their e-versions.
At no point ever in history will a digital download be worth 3.5 million US dollars, which was what a copy of Action Comics issue 1 sold for. You're going to only get that with a really awesome collection that you kept in the best condition over 50, 60 odd years. That's the big reason why you're never going to get rid of hard copy comics ever. Right, so basically, for example,
Brimson unlocks a cabinet. Smiling mischievously, he cradles an amazing Spider-Man comic, issue 9, from 1964. It features the first appearance of one of the superhero's arch-enemies, Electro. On the cover, the villain shocks a falling Spider-Man with jagged lightning bolts. The comic is priced at more than 6,000 rand.
The reason for this is because it is so old, and it's a first appearance of a major character, and it's in really good condition for the age. When it comes to like comics, it's all about condition. That's what really can make your book worth $6,000 or 20 cents.
Brimson reveals he once sold a book for the equivalent of $1,000. He says most people just like reading comics, but others are obsessive collectors.
I've got guys who collect every single Batman. If we get an old Batman in, I know two guys who I phone immediately, and they will be here to check them out and see if they've got them in their collection. The crazy thing is, they probably do.
Music enhances the drama of another display as more clients browse the wondrous aisles of Cosmic Comics, a store that's proud to remain part of a simpler past when comic books, and not computers, were major sources of entertainment. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
Child marriage is prevalent in Nigeria's north, and there are few legal safeguards to stop it. However, the wife of Nigeria's new president, Muhammadu Buhari, has publicly opposed the practice. Chris Stein reports from Lagos.
Wasila Tasiu faced murder charges in the northern state of Kano for killing her husband and three others with a poison-laced meal last year. But a prosecutor announced on Wednesday that the state would move to drop the charges against Tasiu. Maliki Kaliu Umar is the attorney general for the state.
We considered the age of the girl. We also waited until after we were able to speak to the families of the deceased persons. I think their interest must be protected as well. Justice is not a one-way traffic.
Tasiu's lawyers say the girl admitted last year to putting rat poison in a meal she cooked for her recently wed husband. He shared that meal with three other people in a remote village outside of Kano. All four of them died. Tasiu's lawyers said she did not love her husband, who already had another wife, and was forced to marry him against her will. Tasiu's exact age remains unclear, but she was charged as a minor. That means that, under state law, even if she was convicted, she wouldn't necessarily face the harsh punishment expected for a murder. Omar says a deal was reached with family members of the deceased where they would receive money, but he declined to elaborate on the exact terms of the deal. Tasiu is still in custody. The state is expected to formally dismiss charges at a hearing next month. Tasiu's attorney, Husseina Aliyu, says once she is released, the plan is to get her into a school rather than sending her home to the village of Kara, where the nearest classroom is kilometers down a dirt road, and many girls learn nothing more than the Quran.
If we allow her to go, there is no school in that place. What is she going to do? Nothing. So with doing nothing, the parent now would be tempted to marry her off again.
Nigeria has some of the highest levels of child marriage in the world. It's particularly common in the country's northern half. According to the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, 76% of girls in the country's northwest are married by the time they turn 18. In the Northeast, it's 68%. Nigeria's National Assembly passed a law mandating a minimum age of 18 to marry, but Kano State hasn't adopted, neither have many others. Aliyu says laws aren't enough to solve a problem rooted in poor education, tradition, and poverty.
Enacting law will not stop it, because you can enact the law, but nobody to implement it. As it is now, there is this Child Rights Act, and Child Rights Act has taken care of all this. But our people refuse to domesticate it, that is one. Because they realize even if they domesticate it, implementation is not going to be easy for them. So it's better you persuade, you employ means of persuasion. Show them the importance of education.
Nigeria's incoming First Lady has indicated her support for a renewed push against child marriage. Local media reported she spoke out against the practice at a conference in Argentina earlier this month. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Zimbabwe, once a pride of Africa and its breadbasket, has fallen far in recent decades, driven down by government policies, political violence, and economic decline. The nation's leaders, after many years of confrontation, now seek to re-engage with the West, hoping to see an easing of targeted sanctions they blame for many of the country's problems. Some restrictions, in fact, have been removed by the European Union against some officials, and the possibility of financial aid has been discussed. The United States, however, believes that current circumstances in the troubled southern African nation do not merit a change in our policies there, though we remain hopeful that in the future they will. Last month, two top U.S. diplomats, Deputy Assistant Secretaries of State Shannon Smith and Stephen Feldstein, spent 4 days in Zimbabwe assessing conditions there with government leaders, U.S. Embassy staff, opposition lawmakers, and civil society. In the meetings, they reaffirmed U.S. messages of support for the Zimbabwean people and communicated our nation's hopes for economic development and democratic reforms. They also pressed the case of human rights activist Itai Dzamara, who went missing on March 9th after having been forced into a car by 5 men. He hasn't been seen since. What they found was a fractured political system, an economy in desperate straits, and looming food insecurity caused by drought and harmful government agricultural policies. Against this backdrop, they reported at the time, and Mr. Smith repeated in a hearing before our Congress on June 2nd, that U.S. interests in Zimbabwe remain the same. Travel and financial sanctions imposed on government leaders and their supporters linked to political violence and human rights abuses will remain in place, while we continue to support and promote a peaceful, democratic, and prosperous Zimbabwe that provides for its people and contributes to regional stability. To realize these interests, we will remain engaged with both government and non-government leaders alike to work together in areas of common concern. In so doing, the United States remains the leading provider of humanitarian assistance to Zimbabwe in the form of food aid, HIV/AIDS prevention programs, democracy, humanitarian assistance, economic growth, agriculture, and health infrastructure support. Our assistance has saved countless lives, is strengthening civil society, and is laying the groundwork for a brighter future for the Zimbabwean people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.